anybody to leave this meeting feeling like this was a step backwards. Again, now let's...
An unsatisfying resolution for all sides on the Halibut bycatch vote. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Governor Walker leads a discussion on Alaska's future.
And there's actually two T words. One is the truth, we're going to tell the truth, and the other is taxes, or there's going to be taxes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
After several days of emotional testimony, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council voted on Sunday afternoon to reduce limits on halibut bycatch in the Bering Sea by 21% overall. Many in the groundfish fleet say it will take a big toll on their industry, but halibut fishermen in the Bering Sea say the cut isn't big enough to save their communities. As KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz reports, the debate pitted small boats against big boats and Alaskans against fleets largely based in Seattle, and in the end, didn't please many people.
Public testimony stretched over 3 days as longliners from Southeast asked the council to save the halibut stock, crew members on Bering Sea trawlers asked the council to save their livelihoods, and residents of St. Paul in the Pribilof Islands asked council members to save their community. Bycatch has been a simmering issue at the council for more than 20 years, but it's come to a head as halibut biomass has dropped over the last decade. Halibut fishermen across Alaska have seen cuts on the order of 70%, while the amount available as bycatch hasn't been reduced by any equivalent amount. In fact, more halibut is now taken as bycatch by trawlers targeting other species in the Bering Sea than is caught by halibut fishermen there. That has hit few areas as hard as St. Paul. Here's Jeff Kaufman of the Central Bering Sea Fishermen's Association.
If we don't have a job, if we can't go out to the ocean where we live, the waters that surround our community, and earn our living from the bottom of the ocean, that will completely change our identity. And to sit there on the beach and watch as the industrialized fisheries continue to take halibut, if we don't have a fishery, I just think that is absolutely wrong.
Kaufman asked for a 50% reduction in bycatch caps. But industry officials told the council they've already taken major steps to reduce bycatch, like using nets that exclude larger halibut and changing when and where they fish. They said there simply isn't much more they can do except fish less. That prospect terrifies Brian Lang. He's the deck boss on the Bering Sea trawler, the Verdal. He says it's one of the few jobs where he can make a living wage without an education.
So that means that I'm 36, having to start over from the bottom with no education and a family to take care of. It's scary.
After nearly 150 people testified, the discussion moved to the council. Alaska Fish and Game Commissioner Sam Cotton proposed a 29% cut in the caps, calling it the bare minimum to protect Bering Sea halibut fishermen. But the council ended up adopting a smaller cut, proposed by Bill Twite of Washington State. Twite said anything larger would be too steep for industry to absorb. Alaska Council member Duncan Fields said the final vote wouldn't provide relief for communities like St. Paul, embraced by a Sitka audience with quite a few halibut fishermen.
I acknowledge on a personal basis my identity with the folks living in Western Alaska and their loss of economic opportunity, personal identity, and cultural legacy. I get it.
Meanwhile, Twite said he saw his proposal as just the first step in a longer process.
I don't want anybody to leave this meeting feeling like this was a step backwards. Again.
The entire debate was shaken by a procedural curveball. In a controversial ruling, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration forced two Alaska Council members to recuse themselves because their employers have financial stakes in the groundfish industry. Ironically, both supported bigger cuts to bycatch. And the final numbers are tricky. While the vote reduces the bycatch cap by about 21%, the affected fleets have all been well under their caps in recent years. So the new cap is actually slightly higher than the total amount of bycatch taken last year. but the cut varies among different groups. Flatfish trawlers in the so-called Amendment 80 fleet, which are responsible for most of the bycatch each year, took a cut of 25%, or about 15% below last year's actual numbers. Chris Woodley is director of the Groundfish Forum, which represents many of those trawlers. He says that's a big hit.
You know, we're extremely concerned about job loss in our fishery right now, about tying up vessels, and we need to sit down and assess the extent that this is going to damage our sector.
Meanwhile, for Myron Melavidov of St. Paul, the damage to his community looks devastating.
We're basically going to be put out of business. We're shut down. We're sitting at the beach, and that really puts a roadblock to it, with everything we're trying to do for our community.
In the end, all of the council members agreed on one thing. This isn't their last word on the issue. As Bill Twite told the audience, reducing bycatch is squarely on the council's agenda for a while now. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
Governor Bill Walker gathered Alaska leaders from around the state in Fairbanks over the weekend to talk about state services and how to pay for them. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Speaking for one of the many working groups who shared feedback at the end of the gathering, Joe Geldof of Juneau summed up the consensus of many participants charged with solving the state's revenue shortfall.
It's going to require going into the permanent fund earnings. There's no way around that. It's going to require probably some sort of income tax.
In closing remarks at the conference, Governor Bill Walker also referred to the T word.
There's actually two T words. One is the truth. We're going to tell the truth. And the other is taxes. Or there's going to be taxes. We're going to have to do something.
There was abundant praise for Governor Walker taking on the budget issue in such a bold public way. Independent oil industry analyst Richard Feinberg of Fairbanks says he appreciates the governor's effort, but contends there was one key piece of information missing from the conversation.
North Slope profitability and our failure to audit and get that data in a timely manner or get it at all sometimes.
Democratic State Representative David Guttenberg of Fairbanks agrees that oil tax issues were underplayed, adding there continues to be legislative resistance to all new revenue solutions.
A lot of people think there were full grown conclusions. Some people just don't want to talk about oil taxes or income tax or revenue in any forum, in any context, whether it's good or bad.
The political question is, will you participate?
Republican State Senator John Coghill of North Pole agrees new revenue isn't a hot topic among legislators who remain focused on spending, and credits Governor Walker for taking on political taboo like taxes and permanent fund earnings use.
It's easier for the main leader of Alaska to go out and do that than it is for an individual legislator who paints a big target on themselves and can't sustain it. The governor said he's going to do it. He's doing it. You know, good on him.
Coghill, Guttenberg, and others at the conference spoke well of a new state online model that allows users to tweak various aspects of spending and revenue and view the results, a tool they hope will make the budget situation more real to the public and spur action. Governor Walker plans to continue the budget conversation at other locations around the state in coming months. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Senator Dan Sullivan is out of the basement. His staff announced today that they've moved to their new office location in the nation's capital. APRN's Liz Ruskin checked it out.
The office is on the 7th floor of the Hart Building.
Welcome. We found our new digs.
It's just down the hall and around the corner from Alaska's senior senator, Lisa Murkowski. Sullivan was out, but spokesman Mike Anderson showed me around.
One of two conference rooms. One's the video conferencing.
The move means Sullivan and his staff leave behind their temporary rooms off a basement tunnel between the Hart and Dirksen office buildings. In the Senate, what office you get depends on seniority and rank. Sullivan, as a freshman who hadn't held an elected position before, has the lowest seniority, number 100 out of 100. That meant he had to wait for the outgoing lawmakers to pack up and leave. Then he had to wait out a series of other moves as, rung by rung, higher-ranking senators upgraded. The new Sullivan offices have freshly painted slate blue walls, new carpet, and very high ceilings. Anderson led me into the inner sanctum.
So as you can see, this is Senator Sullivan's office. Still missing some artwork as in some of the other parts of the office, you know, still things to be hung up. But yeah, no, this is it.
Is that a real balcony?
It is. I don't even know if there's a key to unlock it.
The office overlooks the historic Thompson Marquard Hall, a ladies' dorm dedicated by Eleanor Roosevelt. Anderson says the best thing about the new office is they have more room. Sullivan plans to hire additional aides to round out the staff now that they have enough desk space for everybody. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, unsanctioned fighting at Fort Rich that helps train soldiers in hand-to-hand combat.
And what it is we take people or soldiers that have never been punched in their face before, and we punch them in the face.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
More than 100 members of the military gathered at Fort Richardson last week for 2 days of unsanctioned fighting. It's an annual tradition testing soldiers' hand-to-hand combat skills inside a cage. And as KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, it fits within the Army's evolving standards for what constitutes a battle-ready soldier.
Every year, the U.S. Army and Alaska's Combatives Tournament brings soldiers together to beat each other up. Combatives is the nickname for the Army's in-house fighting style, a combination of disciplines from across the world that, at the highest levels, looks like boxing until fighters slam each other onto the ground in a tangle of chokeholds, arm bars, and leg locks. The Army overhauled its hand-to-hand combat program starting in the mid-90s, and in the last decade or so, combatives has taken off. In a huge gym at Fort Richardson outside of Anchorage, soldiers, supporters, and spouses crowd onto folding chairs and bleachers around an octagonal ring as the advanced matches are hammered out.
Maybe this is a dumb question. What's it like to get knocked out?
It's actually pretty cool.
Sergeant Sean Ehrenhold is the outgoing trainer on base and a top-level combatives instructor. Ehrenhold is huge, by my estimate, about 3 radio reporters wide. The only reason he's not competing in the cage is because it's his job to help referee matches. He says in spite of a grisly knockout a few minutes earlier, combatives is more than just blood sport. In modern war zones, soldiers may be going on house-to-house raids or conducting traffic stops and need to know how they'll react if stuff gets physical in close quarters. That's why instructors like Ehrenhold practice chokeholds on each other, along with something called an Option 3 drill.
And what it is we take people or soldiers that have never been punched in their face before, and we punch them in the face. It's not a rite of passage. It's a technique to show, hey, you can get hit in the head or in the body and still be able to perform what you need to do to gain dominance.
The second goal of the combatives program, and the one I hear a lot more people at the tournament emphasize, has to do with mental health.
There's a lot of soldiers that have PTSD and that like to fight because it helps take their mind off of things that have happened.
That's certainly the case for Sergeant John Medeiros when he trains after a stressful day at work in his electronic warfare unit.
I don't have time to sit there and dwell on the things that are bothering me in life and stressing me out when my training partners and my coaches are trying to choke me and break my arms.
Medeiros is trained in wrestling, jiu-jitsu, as well as combatives. A lot of the serious fighters like him do combatives courses on base, then fortify that training with after-hours sessions at studios and gyms in Anchorage. Medeiros got involved with all this in the early 2000s while living in Georgia, when an elite group of Army Rangers just happened to be refining the techniques that now constitute combatives at nearby Fort Benning.
As a young high school kid, I was a short little dorky kid. I got picked on a lot, had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder.
Medeiros' wrestling coach knew the Rangers on base and got his impressionable teenage student hooked up with them for extra mat time.
I tell people all the time, jiu-jitsu has changed my life for the better and made me into what I am today.
And Medeiros spends a lot of time coaching other fighters, in part to pay forward the help and orientation he got early on.
A top priority right now in the military in general is there's a lot of suicides going on and people that just feel alone and don't have that outlet for that stress. But if I can introduce jiu-jitsu and combatives to one person that it's able to help put them in a better place and give them a better outlook on life, then I've done something positive.
This year, the 125th Striker Brigade from Fairbanks took first place in the tournament, but Medeiros and others say that's just until next year, when the trophy comes back to Fort Rich. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
10 years ago, the American Dental Association unsuccessfully sued to halt the Alaska Dental Health Therapist, or DHAT, program. Now the program has won a national award for its innovative approach to providing Alaska Natives with dental care, and the idea is expanding to other states. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
The head of the Dental Health Aid Therapist Training Program, Dr. Mary Willard, accepted the Indian Health Service Director's Award on behalf of the team she says has changed dental health in Alaska.
40,000 people now have access to direct patient care by a dental provider living in their community, where there probably wasn't ever one that lived in these smaller communities before. So it's new access.
The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium launched the Dental Health Therapist Program 10 years ago because tribal health organizations across the state were continually recruiting but always short of dentists, and Alaska Native children had cavity rates 2.5 times higher than kids in the lower 48. Dental therapists get 2 years training, including a hands-on practicum. They can do fillings, extract baby teeth, and apply sealants. Willard says they also focus on patient education.
One of the DHAT, Aurora Johnson, reported that in a school where she typically saw 8 or so kids with no cavities out of the 60 in the school, this year she had 34 with no cavities. So that's a huge increase exactly what we're looking for. Our Alaska Native children around the state can and should be cavity-free.
The American Dental Association has attacked the program since it began. The ADA says therapists are not qualified to do fillings and extractions. However, supporters say several studies have shown dental therapists provide quality care equal to or exceeding that of dentists. The ADA has fought the authorization of dental therapists in several other states. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
An innovative Wasilla plan has helped homeless teens get off the street and into housing. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, My House relies on innovation, trust, and responsibility to spur its teens to set goals for a solid future.
It's a typical day at Gathering Grounds. The cafe shares a one-story building on a quiet street with a thrift store and a casual drop-in center for homeless teens who are looking for help. A young man works the espresso machine and takes lunch orders at 2 or 3 modest tables open to the public. What's different about Gathering Grounds is that it is part of a 3-piece plan to get homeless and hopeless teens into a productive life. My House clients are expected to work.
Because it's not a place to hang out. They can come here and do volunteer work or the food bank or somewhere else, but the housing piece really stabilizes them to be able to show up to work on time and be prepared to learn.
Michelle Overstreet is the founder of My House. She started the organization 5 years ago when she realized just how many 14 to 24-year-olds were living on Valley streets. My House has sort of a full-service concept. The drop-in center, a step away from the cafe, is staffed with educational, health, and employment services. A public health nurse and a case manager are on hand. A desk in the center is heaped high with bagels and donuts, a nod to the welcoming atmosphere. Ask Zach Simpson.
I was living under a tree over there behind Cars, actually, and I came in and just to see what it was about, and then they eventually gave me a job in the cafe, and it all went uphill from there.
Zach walked into my house a couple of winters ago with a garbage bag of belongings over his shoulder and two $10,000 warrants on his back.
They helped me squash my two $10,000 felony warrants that I had out for my arrest. They helped me with all my court stuff. Ended up doing some time for my stuff and got that done. And when I came back, I had my job waiting for me.
Since then, Zach has completed carpentry training, moved into his own apartment, and scored a full-time job. He's off drugs now and says he has a much better relationship with his family. Overstreet says that the transitional housing tenants are expected to stay focused on moving toward independence.
We don't have someone there supervising the kids at our housing. They're responsible, they develop a rental history, they pay rent, and we expect them to follow the rules and police each other, and they do a great job.
Another young man, Jason Brayak, tells me that starting at age 5, he had bounced from foster homes in Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Wisconsin before being adopted and moving to Alaska. Then things soured.
Because living with my parents was out of the question. You know, they pretty much spelled it out. They didn't really care, so they dropped me off here in town at the Meadow Road Center, and I was hanging out at Cars about 3 weeks after that.
It was February when he found himself on the street. He lived in shopping malls by day, outside by night, before he found housing at my house.
But they had me in at 10 in the morning, and by 11:30 I had my housing taken care of. I already had doctor's appointments set up to get everything checked out to make sure I was all right. And I pretty much had a job by that point.
Jason has his own place now, is working, and planning to start his own landscaping business. But behind the success stories, there is a backdrop of despair. Michelle Overstreet.
We have a dozen young people in transitional housing, age 18 to 24, and 100% of them are survivors of sexual assault or domestic violence.
She says that's why so many teens run away to live on the streets.
We have several young women in case management whose mothers sold their virginity for drugs. And one of them I've stayed very close with for a long time. And, you know, I said, did you ever talk to her about that and ask her why she did that? And she said, yeah. She said that I was just going to lose it anyway, so she might as well get something out of it.
Overstreet says that the drop-in center helps the state save the $60,000 a year per prisoner cost of incarceration.
There's no comparison. If we're keeping 3 kids out of jail, it pays for our entire case management program.
So far, 230 teens have come through the drop-in center door. Many have stayed in transitional housing and moved on to their own places. At present, there is housing for 5 boys and 6 girls. Overstreet says rents paid by My House tenants are paying for a second girls' house that opens this month. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Juno Symphony has named Troy Quinn as its newest conductor, and he's game to bring pop culture to the orchestra. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Troy Quinn has sung backup for the Rolling Stones and has even been on the popular TV show Glee. Growing up in Connecticut, he says he was influenced by his parents' taste in music. Everything from Barry Manilow to Motown.
My brother and I would do a little show, you know, with combs and microphones, set up in the living room and perform for our friends.
Quinn now lives in Los Angeles and plans to split his time between there and Juno. He says as a kid, he loved learning new songs, but his background is different from most of his colleagues.
I didn't start taking formal training in music and formal lessons until I was in college. It's kind of a well-kept secret.
He calls his piano playing skills proficient and has been a longtime member of the choir. But he didn't think of music as a viable career. That is, until a professor at Providence College called on him to conduct in class.
And I had no idea what I was doing, but I was just feeling the music. You know, I'm of the belief that conducting is innate. You either have it or you don't.
Quinn had it, and his career took off from there. He would go on to earn a doctorate in conducting at the University of California's Thornton School of Music. Juno Symphony Board President Bev Smith says Quinn's charisma stood out on stage.
I just loved watching his hands and his graceful way he conducted. I also remember his warmth, that he was very engaging with everybody that he met.
In that performance, Quinn conducted the orchestra without a score. No sheet music to guide him, only the feel. Executive Director Sarah Radke-Brown says that's something the audience remembers.
For the whole concert, he had no score in front of him. He did the whole concert from memory. And that really, it not only was it impressive, but it really allowed him to be expressive. And he may not do that for every concert, but he was certainly able to make, a more impactful connection with them for that reason.
After the last conductor, Kyle Wiley Pickett, left for a new job, the Juno Symphony received about 70 applicants. Three of those were selected to perform their own concert in Juno, including Quinn. Radke-Brown says they were looking for a conductor who could appeal to a diverse audience.
So many people say that, you know, classical music is dying, that, you know, opera is dying, orchestras are dying. And I think that people like Troy is going to remind people that it's still alive and there's a lot to offer.
At 31 years old, Quinn says he's comfortable navigating social media, like Facebook.
Because I think that's what's going to reach new audiences. That's vital to the survival, I think, of orchestras for the 21st century and beyond.
He hopes to introduce a new audience to the symphony by taking an interdisciplinary approach. There's a movement in the classical world to shake things up.
You know, the music of Led Zeppelin in an orchestral setting. You know, I think that's all great because if people come in to see something like that that appeals to them, and we can then offer them a Beethoven symphony as well, and that's how they may get involved.
Quinn says he's interested in incorporating film clips or having dancers perform the symphony's music. Whenever possible, he wants the arts community in Juno to be a part of that. And if his iTunes playlist is any indication, what he'll bring is eclectic.
Beethoven 5 is on my iPod. Usher and Alicia Keys. It's all music. It's all good. We just need to, you know, have a common denominator so that people can be exposed to some more of the classics.
Quinn starts the new season as conductor with the Juno Symphony in October. In Juno, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Ellen Lockyer in Wasilla, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council is working to protect Alaska's oceans ecosystems and promote thriving coastal communities. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.